This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome back to Elgem Talks, the investment podcast from Legal & General Investment Management. I'm your host, Mark Chappell. Often known as the only free lunch in investing, diversification offers the chance to benefit from the market ups while dampening the drawdowns. But what does it mean to truly diversify your portfolio? How can investors balance different sectors, geographies, and asset classes while still delivering returns for their clients? Joining me today to dive into this topic is fund manager Chris Teschmacher and strategist Duncan Weldon. Thanks very much for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Chris, can I turn to you? Why, at its simplest point, why diversify? What is in for the client for diversification?
So diversification all goes back to the old adage of kind of not keeping all your eggs in one basket. Mm. And when it comes to investments, that means holding a different range of kind of asset classes or sources of return such that you think some will go up when others are going down. And overall, that hopes to kind of smooth your profile of investment returns. Now, that idea becomes particularly kind of applicable when you think about risks out there to your investments. And you might start to think about risks from different places. That could be geopolitical risks, that could be financial or credit risks, and just simply those around economic growth or potential for recession. So I don't want to kind of do this as a market outlook, but right now, you know, we do see that we're probably in the late cycle of the economy. Mm-hmm. The late cycle can last anywhere between 1 and 4 years. But at some point, that is going to come to an end, and that will be devastating for some of the kind of more risky assets in your portfolio.
A lot of people have got have become much more aware of the return of volatility, if to use that phrase, what perhaps were very smooth rides in 2016, 2017, suddenly 2018 was bookended by these big periods of volatility.
Yeah, I think actually 2017 was a really interesting year when it comes to volatility. Okay. And a great way of looking at that is actually how frequently the S&P moved up by more than 1% in either direction, up or down. Mm-hmm. And that actually only happened on 8 occasions in 2017. And in fact, it didn't go up or down by more than 2% at all in 2017.
Not once in 365 days of 2017.
Exactly. And we actually haven't seen that. So the lack of movement, kind of, we haven't seen that since before the gold standard was introduced in 1971. So it's been an awfully long time that we've had volatility that low, and we'd actually consider that really kind of abnormal. So 2018 marks a kind of return to more normal market conditions, and something that we expect to see, you know, going forward as well.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Everyone was looking back on 2018 saying, what a volatile year that was. Actually, it wasn't that volatile. It was just the year before had been so unvolatile that it felt confusing to get back into a more normal condition.
I guess there's somewhat of a recency bias of people find it hard to think back to 2015, 2016, where they're perhaps much more normal volatility times. But because of the stark contrast, a lot of people are slightly more unnerved. But then that creates a lot more thinking about portfolio construction and this issue of diversification.
Yeah, actually, I think you're completely right. So after 2017, after years of really low volatility or benign market conditions, people actually start to question what's diversification really for. Mm. These defensive assets that I hold, or those that perform in different environments, well, they've not done much for me in these kind of benign conditions. I can start to reduce my exposure, or maybe even close those kind of investments altogether, and simply go for those which have provided the better returns, and hope that continues going forward. But with things like, you know, geopolitical risks, they could surface kind of at any time. And we've seen what we think we're now into this kind of world of the new political paradigm where politics plays a bigger role in markets than they used to. And so I think, diversification is something that we hold as a permanent source of risk management, really, in our portfolios.
With the potential for such more radical fiscal or monetary policies, possibly more fiscal with some of the policies put forward by candidates or currently sitting politicians, that will have such implications for inflation, but for broader asset price moves more generally, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what we've seen. Now, often the impact it can have can be shorter, and you can see a return to kind of more normal pricing shortly kind of after such political events. But definitely it can lead to some more volatility in markets. And sometimes those effects can be more prolonged. So everything around kind of Trump's policies, we've seen having a multi-year effect on U.S. equities as well as other asset classes.
Well, that would be something like the tax cuts that they're...
Exactly, yeah. So tax cuts, as we saw last year, had a pronounced kind of impact. And everything that kind of Trump talks about to stimulate the economy, people seem to be reacting to as well.
Could we talk a little bit more about correlation, where if the rise in certain assets, as you were saying, over the last few years, has that created this kind of everything rising together, a rising tide lifts all boats, as it were, and you're seeing a lot more correlations between asset classes that people have traditionally allocated to as a, well, I'll have a bit of this and a bit of that, and those two are very different, and one of them will serve me in the good times. But actually, where does correlation even sit now?
I do think that correlation is still kind of the bread and butter of the asset allocator. Any multi-asset portfolio should consider the correlations between asset classes. But I do think you need to see it over a kind of different time horizons as well. So your correlation between different assets might be low in normal market conditions, but actually in more stressed market conditions, those correlations start to spike towards one, and actually, you know, all your assets start to perform more similarly exactly at the time where you need the correlation to kind of help you out. So yeah. Being aware of that and looking at correlations over time, over different periods, really helps as well. And also, you know, considering new assets into a portfolio, you need to look at how they correlate, not just to one or two other parts that you hold, but actually in the whole portfolio context as well.
It's a holistic view that you need to build here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's often said, isn't it, in a crisis, the only thing that goes up is correlation. And, you know, so whereas you start off by, you know, looking at the, you know, I mean, as Chris says, there is not much utility really in just looking at correlations over the last 3 or 4 years, or even over the last 7 or 8 years of very benign market conditions, which is why when we're putting together a portfolio, you know, a lot of it is scenario-based. What happens in these various tail risk events or these various foreseeable events, you know, making sure you've got that diversification when you need it.
Absolutely. So is it a question of, is it all an issue about allocation? Is it picking the winners and avoiding the losers, and as simple as that? And if you're clever enough to know which ones they are, you'll have a great fund. And if you don't see them, then sucks to be you, but recession's coming your way, my friend.
Well, I'm good. I mean, you know, we can have a debate about whether it's always possible to pick the winners in advance or not. And I think, you know, it sounds nice in theory. It's actually quite hard in reality. But I think it is to do with a lot more than that. You know, the importance of asset allocation, the importance of being aware of the correlation between different assets. And just to step back for a second about the importance of asset allocation. Yeah. I think often people out there will be thinking, you know, I want to make sure I've picked the best fund in whatever I'm interested in. If I want some emerging market equities, I want to make sure I've spent all of my time picking the best emerging markets fund manager. Which, you know, is a perfectly valid use of your time, but there are times when actually you shouldn't have had that many emerging market equities. And, you know, you can have the best of an asset class which isn't performing well in these circumstances.
I'd say absolutely. It's often that, you know, it doesn't really matter. I think if I remember correctly, there was a chart that the asset allocation team did not too long ago, which was exactly that sort of example where you could have picked the best performing emerging markets active fund manager, but he or she would still have underperformed one of the worst performing U.S. fund managers just because of the way the U.S. market went and the way emerging markets went.
The asset allocation piece there becomes really important. And then I think I really want to go back to what Duncan was alluding to there around scenarios. So holding certain assets that you think will really benefit you in potentially risky scenarios, or actually, you know, just different scenarios to the base case. So let's take an oil shock, for example. Yep. Oil shocks typically, you know, have preceded most recessions in the US since the 1950s, or pretty much every recession, I think. And it's typically, therefore, quite bad for most of the asset classes you hold. But if you consider energy companies, they might benefit from an oil shock. Yeah. If prices spike higher, energy companies may benefit. So finding certain assets that will help you in different scenarios is also a kind of a good thing to do. Take, you know, another risky scenario for a multi-asset portfolio, one that everyone considers is kind of the taper tantrum or a risk-off rates rebound risk-off scenario. Maybe in those scenarios, inflation-linked bonds might do better, or holding certain currencies. You know, if rates are going up quickly in the US, maybe the US dollar is going to perform better in that scenario as well. So finding those assets to diversify in scenarios is a good way to protect portfolios as well.
And sort of your ideal diversifiers there, aren't they? Are those that are going to perform well when the rest of your portfolio is not doing as well, but are not going to be costing you money when the rest of your portfolio is having a good time. So it's those sort of trades, those sort of assets which have a positive, if even if small, payoff most of the time, and then are going to really help you when the rest of your portfolio is in tougher market conditions.
So if we try and broaden this discussion to the kind of assets and the diversifiers that are often forgotten about, I know one key thing that a lot of our clients come to us with problems or simply one that they wish to hedge away is currencies. So Duncan, could you tell us a little bit more about the role currencies play in a diversified multi-asset portfolio?
I mean, currencies are another source of return, which is often sort of discounted, whereas currencies can be another source of return, and more than that, can be a diversifying source of return. So you know, when you're constructing your portfolio, when you've got your equities, when you've got your bonds, maybe you've got some commodities as well, there is a role in there for active currency management. Because the thing about currencies is, unless we're, you know, returning to a gold standard, in which case every currency is going to be fixed in value against everyone, currencies are always going to be moving. And the wonderful thing about currencies is, for everyone that's going down, another one is going up. So there is always potential returns out there in the currency market. And another interesting thing about it is, you've got large actors in foreign exchange markets, whether that be central banks who are trying to, you know, safeguard the value of their currency or stop it appreciating You've got, you know, companies out there doing real business, exporting and importing. So you've always got, you know, large market actors out there who aren't driven by short-term profit maximization, which
but
can
they
be
can drive the currency moves as a result of as a result of their actions. I think that's it's something that people are very quick to hedge away because it's somewhat complicated to integrate as a meaningful lever of returns. Is there a way that we can think about currencies perhaps a bit more, I don't want to say practically, but more maybe pragmatically, of these sort of are the drivers of currencies, as you say, these big actors? So I'm maybe off the top of my head, I'm thinking like inflation would perhaps be a big driver of currencies one way or another. Are there other drivers that you would think of?
I mean, ultimately, of course, currency values should on some level reflect economic fundamentals, by which I mean, you know, growth expectations, inflation expectations, and central bank policy determining interest rates and therefore, you know, the return you will get by holding that currency. Of course, currencies do often, very often, drift away from those fundamental values, either because, you know, the market gets very bullish on a currency and people pile into it, or because a central bank is intervening to stop it moving in one direction or another. And when you start to see currencies move away from those longer-term fundamental values, I mean, that's when those currencies really start to get interesting, either on the long side or the short side.
Interesting. And so to move this conversation on ever so slightly, where the way people, investors, or traditional retail wholesale investors think of their portfolio, it is very much a large allocation to equities, a large allocation to bonds. Currencies play a small role. But then there's often an others category, a very, you know, an aptly named alternatives, as it were. And often that constitutes property. It might constitute a little bit of commodities through gold or other such hedges. What can we, how are they being used right now? And what often makes up this other category? And what diversification benefit does it have?
Yeah, so I think the most typical ones and the easiest to access are kind of the listed alternatives, things like real estate investment trusts and listed infrastructure companies. So here you're investing in property and in electricity companies or electricity kind of cables and, yeah. and wind farms and airports, etc. But it's still through a listed vehicle, still through a normal stock that you can buy on the stock exchange.
Quite liquid, quite transparent.
Exactly. So these are kind of the more common alternatives and easy ones to access. And they still present a lot of positives in terms of diversification for your portfolio. Then there's things like commodities, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. In there, I'd say it's important to be aware that if you buy broad commodities, you're actually getting lots of different things. So, okay. for example, oil and gold might be considerable parts of the commodity mix. They're going to behave pretty differently in different economic environments. Mm. In fact, they might diversify each other within the commodities
bucket. Within your bucket of commodities.
Yeah, exactly. If you think of gold as that kind of safe haven, the ultimate risk-off asset, that's going to perform quite well typically in a recessionary environment or in an inflationary environment, whereas oil may be falling because economic growth is stalling and there's less demand for oil, etc. So even within commodities, you've got to think carefully what you're actually allocating to. And then if you move beyond that, you move into some of the more illiquid things or slightly more niche areas like private equities or actually direct physical property, etc. And then we think that there's actually some other areas that you can access as well, which are maybe a bit more difficult for a retail investor because there's some things that stop you accessing it easily. But that would be alternative risk premium, things like value, momentum, volatility, and carry would be the main ones.
These are factors, if I've understood. The factor investing and they are characteristics of a stock rather than, say, market cap through traditional index weighting. They are perhaps trading cheaply or, show good momentum indicators, if I've understood that right.
Exactly, yeah. So I think the factor-based investing is becoming a little bit more common, and actually it's something you can trace back, and most people are quite aware of having a value manager or a growth manager in equities. what's become more common recently is that you can really start to extract the value factor alone just through a more passive approach, basically. So rather than using an active manager that picks value stocks, you can effectively replicate a large part of that through an index which just tracks the value companies or the growth companies. But I guess what we're talking about here is extracting that factor itself. So the value factor, if you invest in value equities, the main risk you're still taking is equities.
Yeah.
There's a small kind of additional factor
there's
on the top.
There's a nuance there. And,
yeah, exactly. There's a corner of the market you're interested in, which is the value part, but the main risk is equities. Now, the alternative risk premium angle would say that you want to extract just the value part. So you don't want the equity returns anymore. Yeah. You just want the value, or you just want the carry element, etc. And it's also important that when we think about this from our perspective, we're not just thinking in equities. We're thinking across multiple asset classes. So that's across fixed income, across equities, across currencies, and it can be done in commodities as well.
Fascinating.
Yeah, you're starting to, as Chris says, just extract that, whether it's carry you're looking at or whether it's value you're looking at, or even momentum, without taking the other market risks. And the thing about this source of return is we think it's not only persistent, but, crucially, going back to what we're talking about, it is a diversifier.
Yeah.
So, you're targeting this diverse set of risk premium. So, I mean, in some, say, commodity strategies, when you're looking at these sort of alternative risk stream premium in commodities, the ultimate driver is the weather in some of these markets. That's what changes the shape of these sort of commodity curves, which you're trying to extract some value from. It's the weather. And, if you've got a diversified portfolio, having one source of return which is to some extent driven by the weather is actually quite nice because, your equity returns are generally not driven by the weather. So it's exposed to a different sort of risk and you're getting paid for taking a different sort of risk.
I think it's so interesting that really what we're talking about here is not only just diversifying your portfolio for the sake of it, you're diversifying the source of your returns, so you're getting returns from a different area of the market than the rest of your portfolio is coming from. And what we're talking there, the alternative risk premium, and you went back to a private equity and the direct property, these are all things that, as you say, the rest of the world, the rest of the asset classes may be quite correlated in a downturn, but these ones may perform quite differently in certain situations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way we kind of look at it is that these factors will perform differently in different kind of market regimes, and those aren't necessarily dictated by the economic cycle, which mm-hmm. plays a bigger part for your traditional asset classes. So taking the kind of value factor again, or maybe taking the carry factor. A carry factor is where you buy high yielding assets and you sell low yielding assets against them. And the way that that performs is kind of not significantly linked to the economic cycle. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's getting different rewards at different times to your traditional assets.
You mentioned the selling the assets and buying the assets all in one go, a kind of short long position, as it were, as a means of concentrating on this very strategic diversify, to mix that metaphor ever so slightly. How can such a strategy benefit a portfolio, and how can it be implemented, would you say?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's hard to do this from your kind of your chair at home through a normal trading platform, because typically what you're going to need is to be able to trade certain assets at very low costs. So that might mean access to derivatives or significant scale or both to be able to implement this. Often you will need to do it in quite significant size, and that may mean taking some leverage as well. Now, leverage is where you kind of size up positions larger than your starting kind of allocation. And what that means is that you can kind of take a bigger position in a factor that has quite low volatility, that's very kind of small returns. So you need a big position to extract any real meaningful returns out of it. And that's difficult to do for the typical kind of retail investor at home, which is why often it's, better placed in the hands of an investment manager who can package those risk premia into a fund or into a strategy that you can then in turn buy as a standalone product.
On a liquid basis, really.
Exactly, yeah.
So, Duncan, we've talked a lot about these different sources of returns and really diversifying your portfolio in a very holistic manner. How can we begin to fit them all together in a portfolio construction methodology?
So when we're constructing a portfolio, one thing that we like to really bear in mind is to manage risk holistically across that portfolio. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a portfolio which has some of these alternative risk premia as a source of return in there, and also some more traditional market risk premiums, you've got some equities, you've got some bonds, you've got some currency exposure, you've got access to targeting these different factors as well, it's important to be always be able to step back and look at risks across the entire portfolio and think, how would XYZ scenario affect not just my market returns, but also what I hope to be my diversifiers? So to always look in a holistic way, to not just look at each individual element of your portfolio as a standalone egg, as it were, going back to our egg in the basket thing.
Yeah.
Making sure you've got your eggs spread across several baskets and making sure there's no scenario in which multiple baskets fall over at the same time.
I mean, that goes back to what you were saying earlier about scenario planning and really kind of looking at certain scenarios or certain events or other things that may affect certain asset classes, certain markets, certain regions, certain currencies even, and how that will impact not just that one position you've got in that currency, but also what the knock-on effects might be for the rest of the portfolio.
Yeah, I think scenario analysis, like we've said, is crucial. We kind of even we're quite extensive on the scenario analysis that we do in our team. Mm-hmm. A way that investors can think about this is that there's really four types of scenario analysis you can do. The most straightforward is to look at historic scenarios. So how would my portfolio have done in 2008, the financial crisis, or in previous kind of significant crises that we've seen? The next is to kind of think about, okay, my base case for the next year, but some potential deviations around that. So what we'd call my macro scenarios that are relatively likely to occur, not necessarily that kind of scary for portfolios. Finally, or the next two would be more the kind of tail risk. So those events which may occur in the next 10 years, but have a disastrous impact on portfolios. And that could be driven by a few different economic factors, potentially political factors. And then the last is event risks, near-term event risks. And again, we spend a lot of time thinking about, okay, how would a certain Brexit outcome affect our portfolios? Or before, you know, the US elections of 2 years ago, how would Trump winning versus Clinton winning kind of affect our portfolios? And so these aren't things that are going to play out over multiple months or years. They will have an instant kind of event impact on your portfolios as well. So, yeah, different scenarios, different impacts, and studying how your portfolio will perform and looking for those which you think are kind of unacceptable outcomes in terms of your investment returns.
Perfect. I think if I've understood, I think that's a really good note to wrap up our conversation on. If I've understood it correctly, it's about really taking diversifying the sources of your returns through multiple different strategies, and whether concentrating on those particular strategies which give you a source of returns that's so different from the rest of the market. But then, as you were saying, Duncan, really thinking about risk in a holistic manner and applying a different kind of methodology to understanding that risk, as you were saying, Chris, through event risk, market risk, long tail risk, and what are the more likely scenarios that we might see play out and how that would affect our portfolio. If I've understood that correctly, gentlemen.
Yes.
always such a relief to hear that, everyone. So glad to hear.
Yeah, just very quickly on that, I think a lot of the words you were saying there were risks, and ultimately, you know, the flip side of risk is reward. So it is about being exposed to many different risks that will be rewarded in the long term. Mm-hmm. The question is, when does that reward come and when does that reward fall away? And so spreading that through time, through geography, through different assets is the key here.
Diversifying with purpose, not just for the sake of it.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us, Duncan.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us, Chris.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to find out more about this issue, we're actually holding a live webinar on the 6th of June called Work Out Your Diversification Muscles. This is going to be a really great event, guys. We're recording at the London Stock Exchange, and the panel of fund selectors and investment directors from across the industry will be hosted by Square Miles, Richard Roma Lee. We've added the link to the registration page in the episode show notes, or you can register for the live webinar at lgim.com/staynimble. Thanks for listening, and see you again next week at our usual Wednesday morning time for more LGIM Talks. Thank you very much. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in Legal & General investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.